Now, just to get some messy business out of the way, because the first presentation I ever gave on the Antarctic, someone came up immediately afterwards and was horrified by my misuse of facts, and said, well, you did not define the difference between the Antarctic and Antarctica. So let me begin with that, because I'd hate to have anyone so upset. Antarctica is the continent, the land mass. Now, during the wintertime, of course, it gets very cold down there, and it accumulates a bunch of ice. Well, the ice is, of course, there year-round, but these ice shelves that we hear so much about, Australians and Kiwis, of course, know all about this, because ice shelves break off and drift towards your land masses. Anyway, the Antarctic refers to the area of the continent, but also of the ice shelves as well. So that is essentially a doubling of size owing to the enormity of the ice shelves, the ice masses that collect around that particular continent. It is, of course, located on the southern end of the globe, and one of the interesting aspects of it is the globe has a continent on the southern end of it surrounded by sea, whereas on the northern tip of the globe, well, we have no continent, we have a sea surrounded by continents. So things are a little bit different, and that contributed to the explorations of these areas. Well, I guess I was fortunate to do a little exploring on my own last year, heading down three times on the Amsterdam. And I do know that there's at least a few guests who join me on some of those ventures. And it seems every sort of cruise that we do, we meet more people who have shared the experience with us. And it was by my accounts, my personal accounts, of course, and you know my fascination with the natural world. This was the premier cruise destination that I have ever done. And you can understand why after I have shared this presentation, hopefully. One of the intriguing aspects of it is its natural beauty. And normally I do share photos, and most of the photos that you will see through the course of this presentation will be mine photographed from the ship. I also shot some video as well, and why not start with a little bit of video, because it really depicts a little bit of the natural wonder of the place. It is an incredibly grandiose place. Many of the islands that we saw had some natural beauty, but boy, oh boy, you are sailing through some mesmerizing places. You can see what the folks are wearing. It's not too cold, at least for an Albertan. And just see behind me there the fascinating landforms, just jagged peaks. So it is not all icebergs, although there are icebergs to be found in certain areas, icebergs that dwarf the size of the ship. In fact, the ship could probably pass through the hole there that is created in that massive iceberg. It is just a powerfully compelling place. And scenes such as this are unfolding continuously, of course, sources of wildlife, 40,000 penguins that we had cruised by on a regular basis, just absolutely compelling formations, swimming by the ship. Of course, there'd also be whales along the ship and seals along the ship as well. So it's just a riveting place. And as I mentioned, there is absolutely no cruise destination quite like it, and that is the Antarctic. And of course, most of those cruise destinations don't leave from New Zealand or Australia. Of course, they leave towards the northern tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, which you see it. It's like an eyelash facing to the north there on that left-hand document. And as I mentioned, we went down on a sister ship, a ship very similar to this one here. And Holland America sends one ship down, and a lot of the major other cruise lines send a ship down as well. The other options would be to go on what's called expedition type vessels, which are a little bit more rugged and a lot more expensive. Those typically only have between 100 and 200 people on board, frequently under 100 for rules that I'll explain in a moment's time. Otherwise, on the big ships, you end up having, like we have here today, so somewhere around 1,500 people going down, and it is just as opulent and wonderful. But one of the things that I enjoyed so much about it, this particular itinerary, it is about the Antarctic. So when you are going down there, all people are focused on that one aspect. The crow's nest is transformed into an expedition center with charts and maps and people constantly going up there to find out where we are going. Why? because the course is unpredictable. We want to get to certain places, but owing to the vagaries of the wind and weather, well, sometimes you can't get to anywhere you want to go, everywhere you want to go, but it doesn't matter where you go. It is a scene of fascination wherever you want to go. So you'd kind of understand the experience on a big ship such as this. It's very nice. It's very comfortable. It's opulent. You have the shows. And whenever you're cold, well, you just sneak right into the ship and you have yourself a cup of cocoa with a little bit of Bailey's Irish cream in there. So it isn't all that much of a rugged experience. Otherwise, if you were to choose one of the options involving the expedition ships, well, obviously, the cost is much greater somewhere. Well, I'm sure some of you have looked at the brochures and dropped them immediately for fear that $15,000 would start leaking out of your hands immediately. Of course, National Geographic and Cork and Lindblad all started out doing this 30 years ago. And one of the differences, of course, is the size of the ship. One of the reasons why they keep the ships very small is so that they could abide by the regulations, which means if the ships choose to land on the continent, there's a rule that only 100 people can get off that ship at a time. They typically go on zodiacs, and they walk around penguin colonies, 100 people at a time per day. So obviously, with a ship of this magnitude, with 1,500 people, we don't have licenses, we don't try to land, because it would be an impossible feat just to manage 100 people at a time. So that is one of the primary differences of the experience. On big ships, you do not land. On small ships, you do land. If you are queasy about the oceanic conditions, and you do cross through the Drake Passage between the southern tip of South America down to the northern tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, well, that can be just a little interesting. No different, really, at this time of year than the Tasman Sea that we're going to be crossing in 2 or 3 days' time when we go back to New Zealand. So anyway, it can be a little bit rough. So would you prefer to be on a large ship such as this or a ship that is considerably smaller? So these are all factors to take in account if you want to have an adventure down to the Antarctic region. The other thing to consider is, of course, they are continually renewing the policies of what can go down and what can't go down. And in a year's time, they will be making an evaluation, reassessing what is going down for environmental protection reasons. And my understanding is, though there has not been any decisions yet, they are seriously looking at limiting the amount of vessels going down there, perhaps limiting ships that do not have ice-reinforced hulls, for instance, or double hulls, those sort of regulations. So do keep that in mind and keep looking in the future as a result of that. So there's many ways to get down there, and when you go down, it is absolutely, truly wonderful. Whether you start your adventure down in South America, that's typically where most journeys begin, areas of Ushuaia, which is at the southern tip of South America, in the Beagle Channel, which we talked about a little bit earlier when we were talking about the Charles Darwin presentation, Ushuaia in Argentina, a fabulous frontier type of town. And to launch down from there is a neat sort of experience. And on the bigger ships as well, because you spend a little bit less time in the Antarctic, typically 3 days, well, the journey would encompass, for instance, when we were doing it from Rio around the tip all the way up to Valparaiso in Chile. I think next year or this year they're just doing from Buenos Aires through that area as well. So you get a little bit more of a diverse itinerary, which includes up to 3 weeks or so. The smaller expedition ships typically just leave from Ushuaia, across the Drake, which is that body of water that I'm showing you across. And the Antarctic Peninsula right there, only about 600 nautical miles south, but it is an interesting 600 nautical miles. Basically, you have the Scotia Plate there, colliding with the Antarctic Plate, so the waters there are a little bit shallow. And as the result of the circulation patterns, that affects New Zealand and Australia, as you well know, being essentially clockwise around the Antarctic continent. Well, you get winds and seas coming from the west through this area, and because you have a little bit of a funnel between the northern tip of Antarctica and the southern tip of South America, you do have these seas that make things a little bit interesting, but those upwellings are very interesting as well, creating the Scotia Arch, and all along the Scotia arched their geological hotspots that has resulted with sub-Antarctic islands. And sub-Antarctic islands are very key for the wildlife in the area, particularly the penguin populations and the seals and sea lion populations, as they populate these areas in huge numbers. Hundreds of thousands of breeding birds and breeding seals all occur in these areas. And some of the tours will take you to some of those outlying islands as well, which are tremendously interesting. And once we get down to the Antarctic, one of the things that you do notice is that there's various stations down there. There's no country that owns the Antarctic. There was a treaty signed in 1959, which essentially has countries making claims to the area, but there are no ownership issues. So as you might imagine, the countries that make claims to the Antarctic, but really are doing nothing more than sending scientific expeditions down there. There's no economic activity going on except for tourism. Well, they have areas that essentially are extensions from the southern reaches of their country. So, for instance, Chile and Argentina would make claims to that area of the Antarctic Peninsula. And the thing that's interesting about it is there are overlapping claims because they are all wanting pieces of the pie just in case economic conditions change, ice melts, and prosperity can happen in these areas. But right now, it's kind of like a gunfight, you know, down in the American South. Everyone's got their guns drawn, but no one's shooting yet. So everyone is kind of at the same pace. The Americans, of course, have a claim. The English, the British, the Norwegians have claims. The Kiwis also have a claim, essentially, from the southern area of south of where New Zealand is. Australia also has a claim. The jagged line there is essentially the Antarctic Peninsula, and there are so many overlapping claims there. South of New Zealand and in Australia, it is not quite as complex in terms of the claims. The Americans basically claim the entire thing, not to just go for one piece of the pie. They're looking for the whole pie. Chile and Argentina are very much, in fact, Chile and Argentina have in the past gone to war in the late 1970s. Well, there's a period of political instability between those two countries before Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands or Islas Malvinas. They had issue with a couple of small islands near the Beagle Channel, just tiny, remote islands that are not populated by anything but seabirds. But that was very politically important for them because by extension, those were southern islands, and the claimants of those islands would have a better claim to the Antarctic owing to the southern proximity of those islands to the Antarctic. So it is very complex, and these treaties, I think they just renewed the treaty in 2009, the 50th anniversary of the Antarctic Treaty, and it is very complex. But so far, because there's no activity in the area, no economic activity, it is pretty stable. Although as you travel around, you basically go from station to station, and one of them will be a British station, next will be a Chilean, then an Argentinian station, and American stations wherever you go, but particularly on the Antarctic Peninsula. And as you get to the area, of course, it lives up to its name as the coldest place on the planet, and there's no doubt that it is the coldest place on the planet. It is also one of the driest places on the planet. Now, it's composed of almost entirely ice. Over 99% of the continent is covered with ice, but because the snow does not melt, any snow that has fallen there for the last literally million years, it remains at the area. Now, in many places of the Antarctic, it doesn't snow at all. Now, when you're in the Antarctic Peninsula, it does snow every now and then because it's a little bit more humid, it's a little bit more, just the conditions are a little bit better for snow, but you don't tend to see too much snow around. It is also, of course, one of the windiest places on the planet with those cold pressure systems sitting there, of course, the elevation as well. And that's one of the key things that I certainly learned when going there is the winds. The winds can be very, very, very severe. It's not necessarily the temperatures. As a Canadian, going in a time of their summer, you're set with temperatures right around the freezing point, a little bit above freezing, a little bit below freezing. So that's not too bad. You dress accordingly, and you're always close to the inside of a very, very warm ship. So that's not too big of an issue. But the winds can be cool, whipping not only from the cold waters, and they are cold, cold waters, very productive cold waters, only a few degrees above freezing point, but also the winds coming seen off the continent itself. As we'll see, this is a high place. It's not a flat continent. It's not flat like the islands that we have been seeing. It is very, very high in elevation. So we know that cold air sinks. And a big continent like this can generate huge katabatic winds, essentially that cold air sinking from the center of the continent, zipping all the way down. And I can remember a time on this day right here, going through the Antarctic Sound, seeing all these icebergs, and the wind was howling pretty good. We round a corner, and we get hit by one of these winds coming down from a long chute, essentially, probably several hundred miles long. And it just listed the ship over, not dangerously so, but instead of rocking back and forth, sometimes we're used to, it just pushed it all nice and over to a pretty good degree. And then, you know, plates were dropping just about everywhere, which made quite a bit of excitement. But the folks of the Antarctic expedition, they like the excitement. It's about the expedition. It is about adventure. And this is probably one of the last true adventures that you can have. It is a humbling experience, because even with the opulence of a cruise ship, you are, of course, always concerned about Mother Nature in this particular environment. And you are awed by Mother Nature as well. As I said, it is a very high continent. On average, it is the highest continent on the planet. So it doesn't have the highest peaks, but the average elevation is tremendous. In fact, in most places as we cruise through these areas, the cliffs rise straight up, just like you would experience in Milford Sound or in the coast of Alaska, and they just flop right up to the South Pole, which the South Pole is located at 9,300 feet. The average elevation is 7,500 feet, which is very, very high. So that's one of the arduous aspects of living at the South Pole. Not only is it the coldest place on the planet, or one of the coldest places on the planet, it is one of the highest places on the planet as well. So those folks that I'm going to talk about in a few moments' time who set out to get to the South Pole not only had to go to the southernmost place on the planet, but they had to climb nearly 9,500 feet to get there, as opposed to the Arctic and going to the North Pole. Well, you didn't have to. The North Pole is essentially at sea level because it's sitting on ice. So these things make it a very diverse but awesomely beautiful place, which houses most of the fresh water on our planet. Over 95%. The fresh water is locked up in the ancient icebergs, the ancient glaciers that compose much of the Antarctic. As it is very high in places, of course, much of those valleys is filled with glaciers because the ice age is still gripping this particular continent. So one of the interesting aspects of cruising down there and having a cruise that goes through the fjordlands of Chile is that you get a chance to see an area that is undergoing an ice age, which is the Antarctic, and then you come through the fjordlands of Chile, which is similar to the fjordlands of Milford Sound or Norway, and you get to experience a place that where the glaciers have receded, where the ice age has terminated 30,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, and you see the impacts that moving ice can have on a landscape. It is absolutely glorious, but it is the least well-known continent on the planet. Very few people have visited there. Only about 300,000 people have ever visited this particular place, and that's exceeded, of course, on a daily basis or on a yearly or monthly basis by Sydney, for instance, where you get, I'm sure, 300,000 people through there in a month's time. So it is an awesomely experiential place to go, and while you have the opportunity to do that, I strongly recommend that you do spend a little bit of time. But as it is least known, there's, of course, a lot of things that, of course, are intriguing about it. First and foremost is probably some of the most famous residents of the Antarctic, and that would be penguins, of course. And the March of the Penguins was a revolutionary documentary film made by some French filmmakers, and it was an awesome showcase of the harshness of life in the Antarctic. And piggying up on that is, of course, all the great effects that penguins have, the endearing aspects that penguins have to young children and to anyone. People just love penguins, and we see that even in Sydney Harbour, where there's 60 or 70 little penguins or fairy penguins or blue penguins, whatever you want to call them. But they're in the harbor, and there's a tremendous amount of support, of wooing, compassion for this particular bird. I've written 20 books on bird watching in the Northern Hemisphere, and people like birds, but people love penguins. There is a humanity about them, probably as a result of their physical form. They look like little people with flippers, I guess. So it can be a source of interaction, a little bit more of an amicable relationship with penguins. And certainly penguins on the Antarctic are one of its greatest sponsors. But there's, of course, a lot of confusion over penguins and various other forms of wildlife that occurs, the Gary Larson cartoon. And now Edgar's gone. Something's going on around here with penguins talking to a polar bear with a bill on its face. Of course, the problem with this is there are no polar bears in the Antarctic, and there are no penguins up in the Arctic. The penguins are a southern hemisphere thing, whereas bears are a northern hemisphere thing. Remember, if you want to think of why there are no mammals in the Antarctic, aside from marine mammals, it's very isolated. There's very little things to eat. But also, it was joined to Australia. It was the last continent to be joined to Australia when Australia was breaking apart. New Zealand had already broken apart by that time. So mammals were very much in the early stages of development. Things like monotremes, which are your echidnas and platypuses if you're from Australia, and also the marsupials. And marsupials have enough of a hard time surviving elsewhere in the world aside from Australia, owing to the fact that Australia has a very stable environment over the last 100 million years. Well, the Antarctic is anything but a stable environment and a very difficult landscape for any land-based mammals to survive. But the reason that there are no land-based mammals, of course, is one of the central reasons why you have all these nesting birds. And perhaps the greatest one of them all is the emperor penguin. Now, we didn't see any emperor penguins because emperor penguins tend to nest far inland, as you well know if you've watched the BBC films or March of the Penguins. And it is a tremendous life history that the emperor penguin does have. The emperor penguin is about the largest penguin on the planet, and they do occur in areas all around the Antarctic, the continent of Antarctica, but primarily they do not occur in and around the Antarctic Peninsula, though they're occasionally seen swimming around the area. So you're familiar with their great feats of reproduction, as exemplified in the life history shown in the March of the Penguins. Essentially, the pairs bond up out at sea, and then they do these marches, 60-mile-long marches, 100-kilometer-long marches, into these areas, basically on land. By the time that they pair up, of course, they've got to transverse these areas of ice, these sea ice, basically, to get to areas of land where the female will lay an egg, pass that egg over to her mate, her partner, her male, who has a big flop of belly flab that just goes over top and keeps that egg warm. She then immediately turns around and heads back that 60-mile journey back to the oceans and begins feeding. He stays there incubating that egg, making sure that no cold air touches that egg. And those are the scenes of the males huddling around versus the most severe winds and weathers on the planet. Eventually, the female does return. When she does return, the egg has generally hatched. The chick is hungry. The male, of course, has very little food that he's been able to regurgitate through this time. The female comes back nice and full and regurgitates food that she has collected and stored in her crop, essentially that gizzard-like thing that you've seen in chickens. It's expanded in penguins to hold food for a longer period of time. In that capacity, the chick has its first meal, upon which the male takes off. And then upon the male's return several weeks later, he disgorges more food to complete the process that the young chicks have. So it is an incredible ordeal, a very, very long life cycle in some of the most horrid conditions anywhere. And that is a fascination with the March of the Penguins. And time again, people come up and say, "Chris, I can't imagine how any animal could live in those conditions." And it's absolutely true. But the truth of nature is, and why I'm so fascinated at each and every turn, is the marvel of the adaptability of animals going to the extreme. They never play right down the middle because the middle is dangerous. So you have to live at the edge. And just this week in Fiji, for instance, I was looking at sandpipers. Sandpipers walking along the beaches in Fiji. And where were those sandpipers from? They're from Alaska and northern Canada. That is where they breed. So in the wintertime, in the fall period, they migrate operate across the greatest span of ocean anywhere in the world, stopping off in Hawaii and then in Fiji and not making a single stop between that, demonstrating that you do have tremendous feats, not only in the Antarctic, but also in each and every one of your backyards as well, the fascination with nature. But the great thing about the Antarctic, it is not only a place that holds fascination in nature, but also some of the greatest feats of exploration. And we've touched upon a few of them as a result of previous lectures and previous adventurers in these waters. And of course, we have to start things off with our friend Captain James Cook, who made several trips through the South Pacific. But the one in his second trip in 1773, in particular, was intended to find that southern continent, a southern continent which eventually ended up becoming Antarctic, though he did not find it. He pushed south as far as he could into the pack ice, which was accumulating, but went no further, unable to find the southern continent that is known as the Antarctic, however, crossing that Antarctic Circle, which is 66.6 degrees to the south. So although he did not find it, others which would come thereafter would end up crossing the Antarctic Circle and finding and making additional discoveries. On the Cook Expedition, of course, owing to the great natural legacy of Joseph Banks and others, well, they did make discoveries of many critters in and around the areas, the same critters that you would find more commonly in the Antarctic, things like chinstrap penguins described by these German naturalists on the second expedition. They also discovered a place called a South Georgia Island, and that was done on the second expedition as well. So on the last expedition, he was also not to go to the south, but to the north to find that Northwest Passage, though he was unsuccessful in finding the Northwest Passage. Years would pass, decades would pass. The Admiralty would be involved in the Napoleonic Wars, so they would have their attention diverted. Following that, there'd be another series of expeditions both to the south and to the north. And even though these are at extreme opposite ends of the globe, they are related to one another because you had these tremendous field admirals, these captains of ships who would hone their craft during the Napoleonic Wars and then would hone their crafts again, either heading to what is now known as the Canadian Arctic, gaining experience there, and then using that experience to try to have adventures in the southern realms of the world as well. John Ross and his nephew James Clark Ross are examples of that. In 1829 to 1833, they spent two straight winters in the Canadian Arctic trying to find that same Northwest Passage that befuddled Captain James Cook, essentially a passage through the northern part of Canada and Alaska to shortcut the journey between England and the Spice Islands and territories off into the Pacific. They were unsuccessful to find it. The ice came in. But they learned valuable lessons, learning lessons from the native people who lived in that area. Down in the Antarctic, of course, there are no people who live in the Antarctic, never have been people living in the Antarctic. One of the lessons and survival lessons that they were able to glean and some of the reports that they came back were areas of magnetic importance, and that includes the magnetic North Pole discovered by James Clark Ross during this time in the early 1830s. And this is very important because, of course, at this time, the compass was the means for direction, so you have to know where that magnetic North Pole was. Now, North Pole actually shifts over time so that if you were to map it today, it would not be found right there. It'd be found actually far to the north and to the west, slowly drifting out of Canadian land. And all us Canadians are very sad about losing the North Pole. It's leaving us. But that shifts, and so does the South Pole. So who do you think they decided to send down to the South Pole to find the South Magnetic Pole? But James Clark Ross. So they send him on two ships, the Erebus and the Terror, down from England to pursue the same course of action that James Cook sent and going south of Australia, spending quite a bit of time in Australia, visiting the governor at the time, a fellow by the name of John Franklin, who was the governor of Tasmania. And John Franklin made a huge name for himself as an overland explorer in what is now Canada. And he was rewarded with the governorship of Tasmania, which didn't actually work out all that that well for him, more on Franklin just a little bit later. But he ended up hitting the Southern Ocean and making some very significant discoveries, being the very first person to note that he saw the Antarctic continent, circumnavigating the Antarctic continent, and naming the Antarctic continent, not Antarctica, but he called it Victoria Land, after the queen of that particular time. He was not the first person down here, though. He was the first person to claim it, because he was sailing under the British flag, and their intention was to claim areas. But it was clear that other people had been there before James Clark Ross, people with other interests, selfish interests, interests that should not be shared with other people, with other nations. And it was the whalers and the sealers who were killing the marine mammals, boiling them down, using their oil and blubber and fat to light the candles of and the street lamps of London. When Charles Dickens talks about the lamplighters in his various novels and pouring the oil into those lamplights in the mid-19th century, well, what he's referring to is whale oil, seal oil, which for the most part during this period of time came from this area. So in this case too, even though he was one of the very first to get down to these areas and chart these areas, others had been there before and already by the 1840s had taken a tremendous toll on the wildlife of the area. He foresaw the slaughter that was looming ahead and said they will now be made to contribute to the wealth of our country in exact proportion to the energy and preservation perseverance of our merchants, meaning that the seal population in particular would be devastated over time, and he was absolutely correct in that assessment. He left his name in many places in the Antarctic. Ross Island, perhaps the most famous island down in this part of the world where McMurdo Station is located. When the flights leave from New Zealand, they predominantly go down to McMurdo, which is one of the big bases of operation just outside the continent itself. On that island, of course, you have Ross Island and the two peaks, which are now called Mount Terror and Mount Erebus, after the two ships that he sailed down there. Both volcanoes indicating that this area is a region of volcanic activity. Incidentally, that one governor that he met down in Tasmania, Sir John Franklin, who was knighted at that time, well, he kind of fell out of stead. He had a very strong wife, Lady Jane Franklin, Lady Jane. Most Australians would probably be familiar with her. Well, he kind of fell out of disarray, and then the Admiralty decided to reward him with a ribbon-cutting ceremony that would have him go through the Northwest Passage, thinking that they had charted it all out and it would be no problem. So they sent the 61-year-old veteran of the Admiralty on two ships, the Erebus and the Terror, the same two ships that went down to the Antarctic, and Franklin sailed those ships into the Antarctic and disappeared, and none of his men were seen alive again. Other ages of exploration, particularly trying to reach the South Pole, was gripping the world during the late 19th century. The search for Shangri-La, Machu Picchu, the North Pole, the South Pole, all these sort of things were on the forefront of people's minds, and expeditions and explorers were at the height of interest during this particular epoch. And it began down to the South Pole with a Belgium expedition, the only Belgian expedition. It was unsuccessful, but it did have some very important people on it that learned very important lessons about traveling to this part of the world. Amundsen, one of my favorite blokes, he was a Norwegian. Well, Norway wasn't a country back then. It was still occupied by Sweden, but it was shortly to get its independence, and a fellow by the name of Cook, both who would make great names for themselves in years to come. A second expedition organized by the same Scott, Robert Falcon Scott, who's an Englishman, and then an Irishman was his right-hand man, the legendary Ernest Shackleton, a great Englishman, and they tried also to get to the South Pole in 1904, but were unsuccessful, but were able to make it back. This great Norwegian that I keep talking about, well, he, of course, was predisposed to cool weather and cross-country skis, so he was a natural to be a polar explorer. He diverted his attention from the South Pole for a while to become the first person to finally get through that Northwest Passage. Northwest Passage that befuddled Captain James Cook, James Clark Ross, and John Franklin. Well, Roald Amundsen actually was able to sail through this area, but had to spend two winters locked up in the Canadian ice as it was slowing his progress. But one of the amazing things that he learnt during this time was how people survived in harsh conditions. He spoke with the Inuit people. He saw what they ate, how they dressed, how they used dogs, how to survive, and in fact, how to thrive in these frigid conditions. And those lessons, of course, were very humbling because he did not bring his European authority upon them. Say, oh yeah, we have to wear petticoats and we have to use charts and drink tea and hardtack. No, he followed the advice of the people who lived in the area, and that ultimately led him to rewards in the north and in the south as well. Becoming the first to go through the Northwest Passage, he could basically write his meal ticket. Unfortunately, he was not on the next expedition to the South Pole. Ernest Shackleton led an expedition to the South Pole, and he got close. Oh, he got so close, he could almost taste it. Remember, the charts had to be made, and you're talking about tremendous amounts of elevation. You had to climb up glaciers, cross crevasses in this very, very dangerous landform. There was no food to be had. You had to bring your own provisions, make drops along the way, and then hope as you retrace your steps that you can pick up these food caches on your way back. It wasn't just getting to the pole, but it's getting back. And on this second Shackleton expedition on the ship, the Nimrod, well, he got close. He got within 97 miles of the South Pole. He actually got to the South Magnetic Pole. And his big fame to claim is finding that South Magnetic Pole. But they failed by 97 miles, which is essentially 200 miles, because as you get there, you have to come back to that food cache. So it is a great distance, getting all the way down to 88 degrees and 23 minutes. He was on a ship called the Nimrod, so he got back safely. He sailed that ship back to New Zealand, to a place called Stewart Island, where we were at only about 2 weeks ago. Very, very small island, very similar to some of those very small tender ports that we were at. He pulls in there and he sends a telegram to his wife, and that telegram states to his wife his distress at not making the South Pole. He said, "I thought, dear, that you would rather have a live ass than a dead lion." Just an indication of how brokenhearted he was about not getting to the South Pole. Others would, of course, be not only trying for the South Pole, but the North Pole as well, which was yet to be discovered. Many parties were going up to the North Pole. And in the years 1908 and 1909, there was various parties, American parties and British parties, who made it up to the North Pole. The two big rivals is this Cook fellow, Francis Cook, that we've mentioned a few times, who had tried and failed to get down to the South Pole. Also, this Peary, who is an American, and both claim to have reached the North Pole, each in different times, in 1908 and 1909, and their supporters, their sides, and their sponsors had great rivalries, combating one another about the authenticity of the accounts. And as time has lapsed and tempers have cooled, a lot of the historians have looked on each of their individual records and had questions about the possibility of either of them actually getting to the North Pole. It's perhaps true that neither of them got to the exact North Pole. Perhaps one of them did. And you see at the time them fighting it out over the issues with the penguins, of course, sitting around the North Pole for some unknown reason. I guess the penguins were the first to get to the North Pole all the way from the South Pole. Who better? The chase to the South Pole really unwound, reached its pinnacle Roald Amundsen, the great Norwegian, and Robert Falcon Scott, the Englishman, who both had made attempts previously to 1911. The North Pole was out of bounds, out of reach. Supposedly people had already got there, so you had to make your name to the South Pole. And Scott and Amundsen both led separate expeditions to make it to the pole. And both were very well prepared, but they both had different ideas of how to get there. They would take both different routes as well, essentially coming from the area of New Zealand, basically from that angle over this massive ice sheet and then hitting into the center of the colony in two different ways. Scott would take the path followed by Ernest Shackleton. Remember, Ernest Shackleton got within 100 miles, so they'd follow that route. Well, Amundsen decided to go his own way. There's differences in philosophy as well. Amundsen, because he was Norwegian and born with cross-country skis, well, he'd ski and he'd use dog teams. The dog teams that he saw that were so successful up in the Canadian Arctic. Well, Scott, after great discussion with the Admiralty and the Navy and the sponsors, decided to use men pushing sledges, which were like giant canoes laden with equipment, and push that over ground. There are advantages and disadvantages to both techniques. And both, of course, would race to the pole. They were both on the edge waiting for the weather to break at the exact same time, very much aware of each other's presence and the glory that was at stake. Robert, Falcon Scott, and a party of four others reaches the South Pole on January 17th, 19th. They plant the Union Jack right there on the South Pole. They pose for a picture, but they don't look all that happy. It's not just frostbite, because as they arrive there, there was a note for them, and that note was left by Roald Amundsen, because Roald Amundsen beat him there by less than a month. December 14th, 1911, one of only two pictures that he took on his entire journey. And the dogs were smiling. The dogs weren't looking at the camera at this point. The second picture, the dogs are looking at the camera at this point. They traveled very lightly, they traveled very quickly, and with absolutely no interests other than getting to the pole and back. The Scott expedition had scientific purposes. They were collecting geological specimens. They were collecting rocks and hauling these rocks with them to the pole and back. Amundsen was traveling very light with dogs. And what could you do with the dogs once you started to get hungry and you started running out of these food caches? Well, you do exactly what the Inuit told them to do. You start eating your dogs. And that's precisely what happened. So the only one to get back from the South Pole in this photograph is Roald Amundsen. Unfortunately, none of the dogs made it back. And that, of course, is the key to getting back from the pole. It's not just getting there, but getting back. And Amundsen certainly did make it back, but who did not make it back was that party of Robert Falcon Scott. He made it back within 11 miles of the closest food cache, but the weather and the insufferable conditions debilitated much of the remaining part of his crew. One of the crew members simply just walked off at night, knowing that he was a burden to the rest of them, and said, "I'll be back shortly." And everyone in that tent that knew him knew that he was not to be back. He simply wandered off to be swallowed up by the incredible cold of the Antarctic ice sheet. And that cold took the rest of their lives in a small tent. And that last day, Robert Falcon Scott, who was thought to be the last person surviving in that tent, wrote in his last entry in his journal, "We shall stick it out at the end, but the end, we are getting weaker, of course, and the end cannot be far. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. R. Scott." Last entry: "For God's sake, look after our people." And he died in that small tent. It was discovered about a year later by a recovery mission that came and found that tent. They took the journals and some of the artifacts. They left the men there, and they buried it with a snow cairn. And ironically enough, because they were on the outer ice shelves, well, that moves, of course. And to this day, wherever they are buried, deep inside a glacier, that is pushing them in the direction that they had intended. And they certainly traveled more than 11 miles, well past that food cache, as they continue to push up towards the Southern Ocean in that way. Well, of course, South Pole was then achieved. And there was this young man called Ernest Shackleton who had great aspirations. He wanted to become a hero in the light of Amundsen and other great discoveries. So he couldn't make the South Pole as that was done. So he decided to traverse the southern continent, to walk all the way across Antarctic. So he needed to get men to do this very feat. So he put an ad in the newspaper, and that ad said, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success." It's the exact same help wanted ad that I answered when I took the job as Holland American travel guide. So anyway, he puts this out right before the First World War, and even though war was imminent, the brass in the British Navy and British Admiralty told him to proceed because the pride of the nation was at stake. His plan was to come from South Georgia Island that was discovered in the Cook Expedition, sail south to the Weddell Ice Shelf, cross that ice shelf to the South Pole, and then follow the line essentially that he carved out, and Robert Robert Falcon Scott took down to the area of McMurdo Sound, basically retracing the path of the others on the last leg of the entire trip. It was a very inspiring move, and one for the ages, as it is one of the great stories in the age of exploration. They take a ship called the Endurance, a great ship fortified by Scottish oak, and they came on down through the Pacific, the South Atlantic, all the way to South Georgia Island. On the way to South Georgia Island, if you could believe it, they find a stowaway on board. His name is Blackborough. Like, if that job, if you're not even getting paid, that doesn't sound like a good job. Here's someone who's stowawaying on board to, you know, risk his life and limb to walk across the Antarctic. But such was the age of exploration and the aspiration for greatness. So they ended up going all the way down to South Georgia Island, then plunging into the Weddell Sea, which of course was frozen at the time, more frozen than they had thought. So just like so many other adventurers had to deal with over time, well, they get locked in the sea ice. They make camp called Ocean Camp, and they, because they're fine English people, well, they start playing soccer and having tea time at the appropriate time. But over the weeks and months that they were locked in there, something started happening to the Endurance. It started listing over to the side. The great compression with the sea ice started doing damage to the ship, such that eventually the ship was crushed and destroyed. You're on a floe of ice, not a soul within 1,000 miles of you, and your ship is, of course, crushed. Now, of course, all hope to get to the South Pole was lost. They were able to salvage the lifeboats on that ship. And from this point on, it was a matter of getting the men back home safely. And it was not an easy job at all, because they were in the middle of nowhere, sitting on a pack of moving ice. Fortunately, the ice was moving in the right direction. It was moving to the north. Not that that's going to help them all that much. It's going to get them 1/10 of the way to safety. There are no stations. There's no research stations at that time in the area. But the ice starts moving to the north, which is a good thing. And there's seals and there's penguins that pop up for fresh air every now and then. And they've got lots of food for 3 years, so food is not an issue. But of course, it is cold and it's windy and it's wet, so the men are not all that happy about it, but they're heading in the right direction until, of course, the ice starts breaking up, which is not necessarily a good thing. You know, it's all fair and good, but as soon as you start getting on smaller and smaller and smaller ice floes, you have to start making decisions what you're going to keep and what you're not going to keep, because eventually they realize that they're going to have to get into those lifeboats. And eventually, of course, near the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, it becomes apparent that the ice floes will no longer be large enough to sustain them, and they're going to have to get in these very small boats. And that, in fact, is what they ended up doing. But where to go? Are you going to go to the Antarctic tip, or are you going to find some other island? And they decide to head to a place called Elephant Island, which was charted as a result of its elephant seal population. So sealers went there to harvest the elephant seals in the area. And I've seen it. It's a rugged, horrible place that there's really very little beaches or any place to land at all. But they were so desperate, they had no provisions, they just kept on going, and that was the only island that they conceivably get to in those small little lifeboats. And they get to a place called Cape Valentine, which is just a little exposed rocky point of land. Now, throughout this whole time, not a single man was lost. Everyone was in relatively good shape, except that stowaway, who did not have the appropriate footwear because he was stowed away. They did not have the appropriate boots for him, so his feet were in an awful way. They were horribly frostbitten. But it is an example of the great leadership of Ernest Shackleton. He had taken Blackborough on as one of his men, put him to work, and he was very much a part of the team. As a symbolic expression of leadership, he allowed that man's frozen feet to touch land for the first time. After nearly 500 days between leaving South Georgia Island and being on the pack ice, between touching lands again, it was those frostbitten feet that touched land for the first time, and they stayed for a few days at Cape Valentine. But they soon recognized that we can't stay here at Cape Valentine. There's no food here. There's a little bit of fresh water from the glacier up ahead. We've got to find another source. So they send out a fellow by the name of Wild around the corner, and he comes back a few hours later and says, okay, there's a fine beach over here. There's about 10,000 chinstrap penguins, so we can eat to our heart's content. We can boil them down and use their fat to make fire. There's no firewood here. There's no grass here, anything like that. So they head out to Cape Wild on Elephant Island. They turn over the lifeboats and they basically make the best accommodation that they can. The men sleeping like sardines right beside each other. The only heat from the fat of the penguins that they are not only eating, but of course using their own flesh to sustain the fires that they are burning. But they're at Cape Wild, man. Elephant Island, 1,000 miles from anywhere, greater than 1,000 miles from anywhere. Someone has got to go for help. And who volunteers to go for help? Of course, the great leadership of Ernest Shackleton. And he gets the biggest of the lifeboats. It's called the James Cairn, a legendary boat that's lost to this day. They fill it up with ballast. It does not have a sail, but they manufacture a sail. They cover it up so that it doesn't get soaked. They collect as much fresh water as they can and food as they can, and they head off. Remember, they're at the northern tip of the Antarctic Peninsula. The closest bit of land is Cape Horn, the southern tip of South America, and the Falkland Islands. But remember, as I said, the prevailing wind conditions come from the west. A ship like this with no keel had no hope of sailing against the wind and getting to these areas. The only hope and the only prospect to find rescue was to return to South Georgia Island, where they began their journey, as there was whaling stations in that area. It would take them to the east, far to the east, over 800 miles across some of the roughest weather around in a lifeboat that would easily fit on this stage. And South Georgia Island's only about 60 miles long. It was a long shot, a shot in the dark, a needle in the haystack, South Georgia in the South Atlantic. Because if you miss South Georgia, the next bit of land is Africa, and you're not getting to Africa. But that's the only hope that he could do. So he and four others, including their best navigator, would set off across the Scotia Arc. And in some of the roughest weather, they somehow managed to get to South Georgia Island. Imagine taking compass bearings, taking star shots on a small ship, rocking and rolling around. And they get right to South Georgia Island, to the middle of South Georgia Island. No one had ever landed on that coast, the west coast of South Georgia. The east coast is where people land. And they couldn't round it because all their fresh water had been fouled by the salt water. They'd run out of food. They were desperate. And they could not round the tip because they could not cut against the wind to get to the area of the whaling factories. So they decide what no one had done. They land on the west coast. They find a little cubby hole and they find a penguin colony, so they have a nice feast of penguin, like they're not sick of that already. They do find a nice little stream, and so they eat some fresh water. They have some fresh water, but still, they have no human settlement on that side of the island. So after having a pleasant night of rest, they decide to do what no one had ever done before, and that's hike across South Georgia Island for 36 straight hours, traversing glaciers that were 4,000 feet in elevation and crevasses that would swallow up whole downtown buildings. Well, they managed to cross the island and get to a whaling village, and of course they found people and possible salvation. But he still had men, almost 30 men 800 miles away that needed rescuing. So they ended up taking a ship out to Chile, and they made four attempts to sail from Chile down to Elephant Island. And all the fourth attempt, they had a steamboat that was absolutely able to make it. And when he arrived there, Shackleton stood on the bow of the ship, and as it coasted up to the shoreline, he yelled out, "Are you all well?" And he heard back, "All well and all safe." And thus ended a 105-day trip by Ernest Shackleton, promising he would retrieve his men, and he did, and not a single one of them was lost. The only thing that was lost was the toes on Black Burrow's frostbitten feet. They had to amputate the toes even though they didn't have a scalpel or knife. They had wire, and that's how they conducted the amputation in this. There are, of course, great legendary stories all about this. Shackleton tried eventually to make the trip again. However, his second trip went even worse than his first trip. Returning to South Georgia Island, he succumbed to a heart attack and ended up dying and is buried on South Georgia Island. It is a big, utterly remote and vast place. It is wild and uncontrollably wonderful as you get down to these areas. There's research stations that we stop in on. Hope Research Station, Esperanza, that the Argentinians deliberately sent a pregnant woman down so that she would give birth for the first time in human history to someone with an Antarctic birth certificate. at the seas, of course, are the reason for all the biological wealth, all the wonders, of it, because the cold waters that feed into the great ecosystem, which is at play, the shrimp, the krill-like animals, essentially feeding the seals, the Weddell seals, the Ross seals, named after James Clark Ross, crab-eater seals, and my favorite, the leopard seals, which we see right from the ship, this photograph that I took right from the deck of the ship. You can see all the red, which is the krill, although there's often red associated with leopard seals. They are the monster carnivore of the Antarctic, and they're just absolutely wonderful. They've got a head the size of a Siberian tiger, and they focus on penguins, and it is a source of the penguin nightmares. It's just a vastly wonderful predator down there. This is stuff from the National Geographic, and you see the size, the most predacious seal anywhere in the world, of course, taking the role of a land-based predator, and just a wonderful thing. It just eats penguins, strips them bare. So whenever you see a leopard seal, you often see a skin of a penguin floating around, and that's just what you have to endure. You are in an utterly wild and wonderful place in these areas. There's whales down there as well. The whales that traverse the Australian and New Zealand waters in migration head down to those cool waters to spend their winters, and of course, the humpback whale is perhaps the most common one in these areas. You see them from the ships the whole time. Minke whales, the small version of it, very, very common through this area. And the birds, albatross, that we'll see in 2 days' time as we cross over to New Zealand in the Tasman Sea. Well, they're abundant in these waters as well, stretching wingtip to wingtip, 11 feet to 13 feet. The royal albatross, the wandering albatross, following the ships in these areas. Tens of thousands of seabirds and albatross. Cape petrels, which we do see actually off the southern coast of Australia and New Zealand as well, in profusion, absolutely monstrous numbers, predaceous birds feeding on the eggs of this vast quantities of penguins and other birds, the great ghost of the Antarctic, the southern giant petrel, photographed here as I did as the snow was falling on a beautiful grizzly day. But of course, the grizzly days are what Antarctic is famous for. And of course, getting into the penguins, of course, just about everywhere. This photograph not taken on the island, the close-up is photographed in the Falkland Islands, and that is included in some of the itineraries, so you can get close-up views of penguins, not in the Antarctic, but in the southern tip of South America and the Falkland Islands as well, but right from the cruise ship, penguins nonetheless, the Delhi penguins, the smallest penguin in the area, frequently seen in the area, and of course, a delight to any person who does get a chance to see them. The predators of penguins, very conspicuous, such as the orcas, and perhaps my favorite bird, the one that'll never make a tourist brochure because it's the ugliest, most ungainly thing out there. You know, as the penguin is super specialized for a life down there in the Antarctic, very dense coat, ability to swim, of course. The poor pale-faced sheathbill has nothing. It's just a generalized thing. It can hardly fly. It's walking around like a cross between a chicken and a pigeon, but it does what it takes to survive, and that's why I like them so much. They even fly to the cruise ships, and they walk around the cruise ship looking at your toes, looking at your feet, looking at anything that is edible, because anything that they can find on the ship is far greater than what they're finding, remnants of penguins, both ends of penguins, the entire life story of penguins is what they mostly eat. They walk around and they look at you with the eyes, you know, of this really prehistoric small bird brain thing, just hoping that it can get a meal for you. There's so many stories, of course, of the Antarctic going through the equaled beauty of Lemaire Channel with 4,000-foot cliffs going right between you, with icebergs coming down. If you've been to Alaska or Milford Sound and seen one glacier surrounded by 99% rock, flip that equation, 99% ice with just a tiny sliver of rock in the area. It is the most beautiful place, the most inspiring place, and a place that I hope I get back to, and I hope you all get to the Antarctic as well. Thank you.